This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the March 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It's no secret that the United States has long been in the business of overthrowing governments it doesn't like. This may be done directly through the use of U.S. military forces or local mercenaries, or more subtly through quasi-governmental organizations that serve as CIA fronts, like the National Endowment for Democracy, U.S. Aid for International Development, as well as freelancers skilled in teaching political organizing in countries targeted by the U.S. for demolition. In the guise of providing education about how a democracy functions, which we could use here at home, using the U.S. as a shining example, their goal is to subvert and bring down the host government. Democrats do it, Republicans do it. If a head of state happens to be in Washington's crosshairs, it doesn't matter whether he's a true servant of his people, a brutal scoundrel, or the epitome of corruption. The latest targets of Washington have been Ukraine, Syria, and Venezuela. In this century, it has already succeeded in bringing down the governments of Afghanistan, Honduras, Libya, and Iraq. Excuse me if I miss any, but in our own hemisphere, we have seen popular democratically elected governments from Guatemala to the Dominican Republic, from Chile to Nicaragua, Panama to Haiti, taken down without the United States paying any price on the world stage. That's what comes from being a superpower, and nobody questions that. In 2002, the U.S. was clearly behind the effort to remove the troublesome president of Venezuela, troublesome for the United States, Hugo Chavez, from office. And that military coup was only overcome because of Chavez's popularity. Now it appears a similar effort is being made against Nicolas Maduro, his elected but less charismatic successor. By maintaining violent protests in the streets, middle and upper class Venezuelans are trying to obscure the fact that despite difficult economic conditions, the majority of that country's largely poor population continues to support the government. By doing so, the government's opponents, backed by Washington, hope to achieve in the streets what they have consistently failed to do at the ballot box. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be taking a closer look at Venezuela when I speak once again with Professor Miguel Tinker Salas from Claremont College, who was scheduled to return yesterday from a visit to his native Venezuela. And he did. Until then, I'm going to focus on the most recent successful achievement of Washington's regime change of agenda, Ukraine, and the escalation by the Obama administration of America's Cold War against the Russians. If it wasn't clear before, it should be now, that in the hearts and minds of the neocons, the Cold War will only end with Russia's total subjugation. Not content with shaping U.S. Middle East policy, they have been in the forefront of producing regime change in Ukraine, and those now calling for President Obama to take a hard line against the Russians. Curious, is it not, there's no mention these days of Victoria Nuland Kagan, husband of leading neocon Robert Kagan, founder of Project of New American Century, who was Hillary Clinton's spokesperson before Obama appointed her to be Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia. Nuland Kagan, photographed marching with U.S. Ambassador Jeff Pyatt in the streets of Kiev with protesters before the coup, clearly played a role in selecting Ukraine's new prime minister, Yatsenyuk. Listeners last month will recall I played an excerpt of a speech she made to Ukrainian Americans in December, in which she noted that the U.S. had spent $5 billion to undermine Ukraine since the collapse of the USSR. You might also remember that a secret recording of her conversation with Ambassador Pyatt, in which she expressed her choice of Ukraine's future leaders as if it was a game of fantasy football, went viral on the internet. To convince Americans of the righteousness of U.S. policy toward Ukraine and against Crimea's return to Russia, our national media has behaved as if we live in a totalitarian state, dutifully following Washington's line and turning the truth on its head. Thus, we are led to believe that it was clearly a coup against Viktor Yanukovych, the democratically elected president of Ukraine a month ago, was legitimate, despite Yanukovych's agreement with the EU to hold new elections. While an overwhelming vote in Crimea by its largely Russian-speaking population to restore the region's historic connection with Russia was not. From the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal to the Washington Post, from Fox News to NPR to The Takeaway, the message was the same. Although Takeaway host John Hockenberry questioned why he was quoting neocon Paul Wolfowitz on the subject as if someone else had made the guest selection for him. It was a reasonable question. Wolfowitz, you'll recall, was credited at the time, along with fellow neocon Richard Perle, as having orchestrated the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Largely minimized after the coup was the fact that the most brutish and violent protesters in Kiev's Maidan Square were members of ultra-right-wing parties and organizations who proudly traced their lineage to those of their countrymen who had fought for Hitler's Wehrmacht against the Soviet Union in World War II and were virulently anti-Semitic. Today, they're not only represented in Ukraine's new parliament, but more importantly, in the country's new cabinet. Yesterday, it was reported that a leader of the neo-fascist right sector organization, Oleksandr Mushuko, was killed by police. He had been a prominent figure in the protests that ousted the Yanukovych government. Accounts differ as to how he died, with some suggesting he was killed in a firefight and others claiming he was alive at the time of his arrest and was killed afterward. We'll see what that leads to. More recently, a delegation of those right-wing thugs was videoed raiding the office of a Ukrainian national TV station, beating up the CEO after the station had played a speech by a Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, and forcing him to resign. They later kidnapped him, and his whereabouts are still unknown. One of the first actions of the new Ukraine government was to ban Russia as an official language. That was but one of the reasons underlying Russia's refusal to accept the coup on its border and for quickly acting to bring Crimea back within its embrace. What is key to understanding the overall situation is to look at the role of NATO and how that U.S.-dominated alliance has unapologetically and aggressively moved against Russia since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and how it broke earlier promises not to expand its military bases into countries that were once part of the Soviet Union or were on its borders. Washington and NATO officials deny such a promise was ever made. Who is telling the truth? Well, November 16, 2009 edition of Der Spiegel online, citing documents that have been recently declassified, backed up Russia's version. According to the German magazine, quote, what the U.S. Secretary of State James Baker III said on February 9, 1990 in the magnificent St. Catherine's Hall at the Kremlin is beyond dispute. There would be, in Baker's words, no extension of NATO's jurisdiction for forces of NATO one inch to the east, provided the Soviets agreed to the NATO membership of a unified Germany. Moscow would think about it, Gorbachev said, but added, any extension of the zone of NATO is unacceptable, end quote. Yet, as then Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said on November 2009, Russia got, quote, none of these things that we were assured, naming that NATO would not expand endlessly eastward and our interests would be continuously taken into consideration, end quote. The political leaders of the day, noted Der Spiegel, are now elderly gentlemen who don't necessarily always find it easy to remember exactly what happened back then. But the record shows, for example, that on February 10, 1990, German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher told Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze, quote, we are aware that NATO membership for a unified Germany raises complicated questions. For us, however, one thing is certain, NATO will not expand to the east, end quote. And because the conversation revolved mainly around East Germany, Genscher added explicitly, quote, as far as the non-expansion of NATO is concerned, this also applies in general, end quote. From what has happened in the ensuing years, with NATO routinely engaging in military exercises on or near Russia's borders, one can well understand why Putin sees in Ukraine a further threatening expansion of NATO on the southern frontier, and why Russia's presence in Crimea and maintaining control of its military bases on the Black Sea are essential for its national security. The mention of Gorbachev, America's favorite Russian, should raise the question, why is he not being interviewed? Why has his opinion on the situation not been publicized? Then I learned that it has, although minimally, because it's not what the White House, Congress, and the media warmongers want you to hear. Buried deep in a New York Times story on March 18th was Gorbachev's opinion that I've yet to read elsewhere. Quote, the consensus regarding Crimea was so strong in Moscow, the Times correspondent wrote, that even the last Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, whose role in the dissolution of the Soviet Union is deeply reviled in Russia, endorsed Crimea's move, telling the Interfax news agency that its independence, quote, should be welcomed and not met with the announcement of sanctions, end quote. And then he added, if until now Crimea had been joined to Ukraine because of Soviet laws that were taken without asking the people, then now the people have decided to rectify this error, end quote. Gorbachev was referring to the decision taken on his own in 1954 by former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, himself a Ukrainian, to make Crimea a part of Ukraine. This was believed to be a gesture by Khrushchev to atone for crimes committed against the region during the reign of Joseph Stalin, the most notable of which was a famine which killed millions of Ukrainians as punishment for their resisting forced farm collectivization. Since both regions were part of the Soviet Union at the time and would remain so for another 47 years, little attention was paid at the time to Khrushchev's action. Now, President Obama and his White House entourage are treating that dubious action as if it was enshrined in international law. Here's some more history that you will probably not hear or read elsewhere. And this is also from the New York Times, from Tom Friedman's column, May 2nd, 1998. His voice is a bit frail now, but the mind, even at age 94, is sharp as ever, wrote Friedman. So when I reached George Kennan by phone to get his reaction to the Senate's ratification of NATO expansion, it was no surprise to find that the man who was the architect of America's successful containment of the Soviet Union and one of the great American statesmen of the 20th century was ready with an answer. End quote. I think it was the beginning of a new Cold War, said Mr. Kennan from his Princeton home. I think the Russians will gradually react quite adversely and will affect their policies. I think it is a tragic mistake. There was no reason for this whatsoever. No one was threatening anybody else. This expansion would make the founding fathers of this country turn over in their graves. We have signed up to protect a whole series of countries, even though we have neither the resources nor the intention to do so in any serious way. What bothers me is how superficial and ill-informed the whole Senate debate was, added Kennan, who was present at the creation of NATO, and whose anonymous 1947 article in the Journal of Foreign Affairs, signed X, defined America's Cold War containment policy for 40 years. I was particularly bothered by the references to Russia as a country dying to attack Western Europe. Don't people understand? Our differences in the Cold War were with the Soviet communist regime, said Kennan, and now we are turning our backs on the very people who mounted the greatest bloodless revolution in history to remove the Soviet regime. End quote. Well, that was Tom Friedman writing about his conversation with George Kennan in 1998. After the Senate had voted to violate Washington's agreement with Russia and expand its NATO bases eastward. The day before, on May 1, 1998, by 80-19 vote, the Senate had voted to bring three former Soviet allies, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland, into NATO. The vote, welcomed by President Clinton, was far more than two-thirds majority needed to approve the resolution. It cut across party and ideological lines, with 35 Democrats joining 45 Republicans supporting it, and 10 Democrats and 9 Republicans opposing it. Enlarging NATO would redraw the boundaries of Europe, the New York Times pointed out, pushing the military alliance 400 miles eastward toward Russia. Perhaps most important for the United States, it noted, an expanded NATO would commit American military forces to the defense of Prague, Warsaw, and Budapest as if they were Washington, London, or Paris. End quote. 5 years later, in 2003, with their foreign ministers looking on from the balcony, the Senate, by a 96-0 vote, approved the further expansion of NATO, adding Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia to the alliance. With that vote, all the Eastern republics that had once been part or allied to the Soviet Union, with the exception of Ukraine, were now essentially under U.S. control, and now that domino has fallen. One need not admire Vladimir Putin to understand why Russians legitimately feel threatened by the decision of the West to back the coup in Ukraine and why it was not about to pay any attention to demands from the hypocrites in Washington that the Crimeans not be allowed to vote for their independence from Ukraine and reconnection with Russia. Meanwhile, the war drums are getting louder as both the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, for example, have called editorially for the U.S. to send a 6th fleet into the Black Sea to demonstrate to Moscow that what they characterize as aggression will not be allowed to continue. On the Post front page Monday, continuing the deception, was the headline, quote, NATO general warns of further Russian aggression, end quote. It was not until the fifth paragraph that the NATO general was identified as U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, the commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Europe. The story strangely datelined Simferopol, Crimea. It described how, quote, U.S. and Ukrainian officials warned Sunday that Russia may be poised to expand its territorial conquest into eastern Ukraine and beyond, with a senior NATO official, still not identified as American, saying that Moscow might even order its troops across Ukraine to reach Moldova, end quote. In Brussels, that general, Breedlove, said Russia had assembled a large force on Ukraine's eastern border that could be planning to head for Moldova's separatist Transnistria region more than 300 miles away. There's absolutely sufficient force postured on the eastern territory of Ukraine to run to Transnistria if the decision was made to do that, and that is very worrisome, Breedlove said. Transnistria is a narrow strip of land about the size of Rhode Island that is wedged between the rest of Moldova and southern Ukraine. It proclaimed its independence in 1990 and in 2006 voted to seek eventual unification with Russia. About 1,200 Russian troops are stationed there, where pro-Russian sentiment reportedly runs high. Stirring up anti-Russian sentiment in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, members of a visiting U.S. congressional delegation said Ukrainian officials were determined to prevent any further Russian incursion into their territory. This would be no Crimea, Senator Joe Donnelly, Indiana Democrat, said at a news conference, adding that Putin would find himself having to explain why young Russian men were coming home in coffins. Ukraine is ready to fight, he said. A year ago, he probably couldn't find Ukraine on the map.